Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones. So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast.
So today we're really pleased to welcome along Jenny Murphy, who's a senior lecturer at the University of Surrey. Her work on interoception has been recognised by several awards for doctoral contributions and early career prizes. She's particularly interested in sex differences in interoceptive abilities, including how these emerge across development and whether they relate to sex differences in mental and physical health. And she currently holds a new investigator grant from the Medical Research Council for investigating changes in interoception across the menstrual cycle. Really pleased to get you along today, Jenny, to talk about this because it's something I'm really fascinated by. So thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
So thanks very much indeed for coming along today, Jenny, and explaining and talking about this. I'm a psychotherapist by training and background and trained quite some time ago, actually. So it would really help me to begin by talking about what is interoception.
It's an interesting one because I feel like I spend all my day, every day, talking about interoception, but I forget that this is not a term that people are perhaps familiar with. So interoception generally refers to the processing of signals that come from the inside of your body. So this would be things like feeling your heart beating, your breathing, and knowing when you need to go to the toilet or something like this. And even though that definition sounds really quite simple, it's probably worth acknowledging right at the beginning that there's quite a lot of ambiguity as with regards to what is and what isn't an internal signal. So some signals are perhaps, you know, unambiguously internal, like your heart or your lungs, for example. But something like temperature or taste perhaps becomes a little bit more complicated. So there is actually a fair amount of a debate in terms of what is and what isn't an internal signal, and also which aspects of interoception that we should be interested in. So people can differ in the ways that they perceive these internal signals. So they might differ in terms of how accurately they can perceive them. And it's worth noting straight from the bat, just because you're good at perceiving one doesn't mean that you're good at perceiving the other. But also people vary with regards to how much attention they pay to these signals, and that's not synonymous with one's accuracy, as well as how they evaluate them. So whether they're likely to interpret sort of internal signals in a negative manner, for example, catastrophizing or thinking these signals might be threatening. So interoception is quite a big umbrella term for the processing of lots of different internal signals and in lots of different ways.
Thank you. That's fascinating. And I can tell right from the beginning, this is quite a complex area. But say a bit more about why it is important and how can it be relevant to our well-being?
Sure. So at the most basic level, we might think that interoception is important for homeostasis. So this is sort of keeping our body in balance. So if we are feeling thirsty, for example, we're too dehydrated, we will be prompted by our bodies to notice this and grab a drink to sort of maintain the balance in the body. And so you could think that if this sort of process goes awry, that we might have struggles with sort of maintaining that balance in our body, putting ourselves at risk of sort of physical health conditions. But perhaps why psychologists have become more and more interested in interoception is perhaps actually by way of anxiety initially. So the perception of internal bodily signals being sort of a common feature of anxiety disorders, but actually more broadly, the evidence base that seems to suggest links between the processing of internal bodily signals and various aspects of mental health. So interception has been associated with several mental health conditions, and the exact way that interception varies in these conditions differs. It's not like there's a consistent pattern, but also that interception seems to be linked to sort of higher order cognitive abilities, and that includes things like the processing of emotions. It includes things like gut feelings, learning and decision making, amongst a number of other things. There's always some studies coming out sort of linking interception with various processes that, you know, it's difficult to keep track of all the different things with which interception has been linked. But I think that people have gotten more excited about the idea of interception because of sort of the applicability of this for sort of potentially treating a variety of different mental health conditions and helping people not only to improve their interception, but also kind of balance things out with regards to sort of attentional processes and negative evaluations and such.
I trained as a sensory motor psychotherapist, and that was the first time I really started thinking about interception, so it's probably about 8 or 9 years ago. And what was really, really fascinating to me was how much it can be used as a tool in terms of as a kind of a gateway to your emotions in some sense. So we had to do lots of experiments where we noticed our internal response to the idea of, for instance, getting physically closer to somebody in a, you know, sitting our seats physically closer or moving away from somebody, what that felt like. And it was amazing how much that could then serve as a pathway to working on things like trauma or developmental missing experiences during development. So really fascinating stuff.
Jenny, I'm still a bit puzzled because you mentioned a moment ago that many of these perceptions are connected with higher order functions. And yet my gut feeling would be that the kind of thing you're describing would be rooted in really quite primitive parts of the, you know, early development parts of the brain. Is that just wrong?
So I would say that the processing of internal bodily signals tends to be associated with kind of the insular cortex, sort of limbic structures, which are generally sort of primitive areas. But these all have connections with these kind of higher order areas areas of the brain that are supporting higher order cognitive functions. So if we take something like emotions are a good example, actually. So it used to be thought that emotions were just changes in the body. So that was it. There's a change in your body and you experience an emotion. But we know that that cannot be the case, and sort of evidence that was collected around the 60s sort of suggested that that's not enough to experience an emotion, because a racing heart rate might mean that you're feeling really excited about something, but it also might mean that you feel scared or you feel nervous. So the sort of overriding context is also important for sort of labelling which emotion we are experiencing. So almost every theory of emotion is ascribing this fundamental role to sort of the processing of internal bodily states in emotions, but it's not the whole picture. So when I say that there are links between interception and these higher order sort of cognitive processes, this doesn't mean that the relationship is sort of 100%. It means that there's sort of a portion of the variance or the ways that individuals can differ in this might be explained by these differences in sort of the bodily signals that people experience themselves. So that we react in different ways. So the stimuli actually changes, as well as our processing of those stimuli varies, and the extent to which we kind of rely on the internal versus the context, so the wider context of what's happening, also varies. So the way that we experience emotions is is complicated, and sort of interceptive aspects do contribute to this. There's various amounts of evidence sort of suggesting links between these two things, but it's certainly not explaining everything that's going on.
Thank you. That's very helpful. So in a way, you've described how you and your colleagues notice things or perceive things. Is it possible to measure this phenomenon?
Ah, what a golden question. Is it possible? It depends who you ask, to be honest. It depends which researcher you speak to. I would say that I'm slightly more on the critical side of things. So there are ways to measure the perception of internal bodily states. Most research has focused on the perception of cardiac signals, but there are some new measures that are more robust, and those tend to be more invasive. So it is very difficult to come up with tasks that control for everything. So if I'm looking at cardiac perception, I can't control the heart. Well, I can if I recruit individuals with pacemakers, for example, but it's very difficult for me to do so otherwise. And so it's very difficult to tease apart the contribution of the stimulus itself and how that varies across individuals from the perception of these signals. So that's kind of challenge number one. But the other thing is that it's very, very difficult to just come up with tasks that aren't influenced by a variety of other processes. So, for example, some of the tasks that I've developed have looked at, for example, how well people can synchronize tones to their heartbeat. And that would involve sort of the perception of these signals, but also the integration of these signals with an external stimulus. So I can't know from this task whether people have problems with kind of the integration of something external and internal, or whether it's a difficulty with perception. So whilst there are loads of cool ways of trying to measure interception, and I've worked a lot on developing smartphone applications so that we can do this at scale, other colleagues have done work looking at sort of vibrating pills that people swallow to measure gastric interception. Other really invasive measures include sort of the esophagus, or, you know, the stomach, using sort of balloons and all sorts of different things. But it's very, very difficult to sort of replicate some studies that are using the very, very invasive measures. And all of these kind of pose that trade-off between the amount of control you have over the stimulus, as well as the difficulty with recruiting participants who might be happy to subject themselves to these more challenging things. Where it is probably easier to measure interception is sort of getting measures of sort of one's beliefs regarding their interceptive abilities. So, for example, how much attention people think they're paying to internal signals. We can use this. Some of the measures that I've developed include using in the moment reports, so sending people notifications to get a measure of sort of how much attention they're paying in the last sort of 5 minutes, rather than using questionnaires. There's several different questionnaire measures as well. So there are ways that we can measure different aspects of interception. But certainly I would say that measurement of interception is probably at the forefront of the field at the moment. Maybe one where the field has tried to run before it can walk, in some ways. And so there's kind of been a shift back towards the development of more robust measures. But yeah, whether these will be shown to be robust in 10, 15, 20 years' time really remains to be seen.
Thank you. So I mean, that leads me straight into my next question, really. How long has the study of this phenomenon been going on? And have you got to the point where you can foresee some clinical effects? Benefits?
So the term sort of is from around, I think, 1905, 1906, something like that. So certainly over 100 years. And it was Sherrington who sort of separated the perception of extraceptive signals, so things that were external from the body, from proprioceptive signals, which is like the positioning of the limbs and the body in space, and interceptive signals, which are internal to the body. So this was kind of the initial separation and use of the term. But in terms of research, I would say that aside from some quite invasive studies that I think were in the Soviet Union around the sort of 40s, 50s, 60s, something around that time, as well as sort of work by Pavlov in sort of just before that, looking at things like classical conditioning, so associating different stimuli together. Yes, there were studies with sort of internal and external, so we know this sort of the dog salivating at the presentation of a tone, because those two stimuli have been associated with each other, so the tone or bell being associated with sort of feeding. So we know that there were studies that had looked at sort of the conditioning or associative learning of associations between internal and internal, as well as internal and external, as well as external and external as well. But I would say that because of this sort of focused on behaviorism, actually interoception kind of was seen as quite a niche field for a good length of time. And I think that it was around the 80s when people were trying to look at whether people had the ability to control their heart rate. So the idea was that individuals might be able to sort of down-regulate, speed up their heart rate and slow it down at will. Now, they didn't find really ever any evidence of this, what they called heart rate control. And so theory came about that, okay, well, maybe this is related to your ability to perceive it. You can't control something that you can't perceive, and some people can perceive it, some people can't. How are we going to measure this process? And that's when the development of these interoceptive tasks came about. People started looking at the relationship with emotions, interest from fields like individuals researching anxiety. And so from the development of these kind of measures around the late 70s and early 80s, the kind of field sprung up looking at interoception in sort of different conditions. But again, it was quite specific, and sort of the publication of a number of papers suggesting that interoception might be this kind of common factor that contributes to why some conditions are very similar to each other. So why things like disrupted sleep or disrupted emotion regulation and such might be present across a variety of different mental health conditions, not just sort of anxiety. The publication of this really sort of spurred interest in the field. So if you look at the kind of trajectory of papers written on interoception, it's sort of very, very, very low, and then suddenly up it goes. So it's been this kind of exponential interest in interoception, and that's where we're at the moment. Although I would say with that increased focus has come increased scrutiny of these methods. And so now we're in this sort of coming out of a lot of critical papers and towards this sort of papers publishing sort of methodological work to try and improve the measurement of interoception. So I think we might be surprised at what is found in kind of the years to come in this field. And so it's probably worth taking everything that I say from our current knowledge with a pinch of salt, because actually it's quite possible that we find quite different things when we try and replicate things that we know in the future. But in terms of clinical applications, of course, things like interoceptive exposure therapies and such, they've been around for a while, as well as sort of perception training used in physical health conditions like asthma is a good example. So training people when it is to perceive breathlessness, basically, and to not overuse things like their reliever medication. And those are quite interesting studies, actually, because they suggest that if you just train accuracy, you actually result in negative effects. So if you just make people better at perceiving sort of breathlessness, what happens is they overuse their medication, which is not what we want. But if you also target sort of these more evaluative processes, as well as include sort of educational training about how, you know, breathing might change over the course of the day and be affected by other things, and when we should worry and when we shouldn't, we find that actually the accuracy training can be useful as well. And this has kind of been applied towards anxiety now. So there's a number of sort of trials and different studies that are coming out looking at sort of how we can train interoception, and generally these are also using kind of aspects of cognitive behavioral therapy alongside sort of educational resources focusing on cardiac perception. I'm a bit of a skeptic on those things, because I would say that in some ways we don't know what the optimal level of interoception is, so it's difficult to know where we should be getting people to. And also, when you're lumping everything in together, you've got a bit of accuracy, you've got a bit of CBT, but you don't really know what aspects it's targeting. Is it targeting your perception? Is this targeting your negative evaluation? Is it targeting attention? Exactly how is this working? And I think as a field, we probably do need to start pulling this apart to work out what the mechanisms of change are, so that actually this can be most useful clinically. And that would be probably in the form of more targeted, personalized interventions rather than this kind of one size fits all approach.
That's really interesting, Jenny. And just thinking back to working in a high secure prison where the population were considered to be psychopaths, so quite dislocated from their emotional awareness, and we used to run affect regulation, emotional regulation groups with the men in there, and one of the things that we found was that the men often couldn't detect any emotion until they were really angry, and they just had one emotion, which was upset. And upset was a blanket word that covered sadness, fear, but mainly how they noticed it was as anger. And so we did spend quite a lot of time doing sort of mindful study of what was going on in the body in order to enable people to be able to more effectively discern different emotional states, which seemed to be helpful, but we didn't evaluate that as such. But that, I suppose, when I was thinking about interception, you know, with that population, the difficulties that people seemed to have was to not be able to discern different emotions, not being necessarily able to recognise when they felt things at all, and because they were so detached from their bodies at times, and then also not being able to discern difference in what they were feeling. But what other kind of problems have you encountered people facing around interception?
So that's really interesting what you were saying about sort of this. It makes me think of alexithymia. So this idea of difficulties identifying, describing one's own emotions, as well as this kind of externally orientated thinking style. And this really should be associated with interception. The results are actually really mixed in terms of objective measures. But what we generally find is alexithymics certainly are reporting that they have more difficulties perceiving internal bodily states, whether this is that they believe themselves to be poor when they actually are not poor. So they have poor sort of insight into their own abilities. That remains to be seen. Or whether it's just that our tasks aren't sensitive enough to pick up on the difficulties that they are experiencing kind of remains an outstanding question. But certainly that kind of idea of where is this difference coming from. So if you can notice a change in your bodily state, so I feel bad, I don't feel good, then certainly you have noticed some at some level a change, so you have noticed some interoceptive signals. And so it seems to be that kind of more higher level. So what we find is that alexithymics also tend to have difficulties recognizing emotional states in other people as well. Now, they can tell that face has changed. They can tell that the expression is not the same as another expression if we show them to, but they cannot label these. And so there's this sort of idea that they may have difficulties labeling their emotional states, and it may be that they also have difficulties labeling their interoceptive state. So that a good example and one that always gets confused is like hunger and thirst. And this hasn't been looked at in alexithymia, but we might hypothesize that someone who is highly alexithymic might struggle to, more so than the average person, to distinguish between sort of differences, to sort of directly label a bodily state rather than just be saying that there is a change. In terms of sort of different conditions, I could reel off lots. So, you know, there's lots of work on disrupted interoceptive processing in eating disorders. Hard to know with some conditions whether it's a chicken or an egg. So you could kind of imagine that difficulties perceiving internal bodily states could contribute towards the presence of an eating disorder, may make this more likely to develop. For example, by way of a mechanism by which you're not affected by sort of restriction of diet, for example, because you have problems recognizing those internal bodily states. But you could also predict the opposite, that actually an individual might have typical interoceptive abilities and after the development of a condition would then sort of deliberately suppress these signals, and that would lead to sort of difficulties with perception. So with all these conditions, I would say aside from anxiety, where interoceptive training, at least in the cardiac domain, has been used, it's really, really difficult to know whether this sort of is bi-directional. So one can, you know, problems with interception feed into the condition and the condition actually then feeds back into difficulties with interception and vice versa, or whether it sort of proceeds or follows in general. So with all of this work, the majority of this is focusing on associations between the two, and that's kind of an important caveat. But there's also other conditions that have been associated, OCD, with heightened perception of internal signals. There's also conditions like schizophrenia, depression associated with sort of blunted processing of internal signals. But again, all of this work is kind of generally using these older tasks, which we know are sort of perhaps less than ideal. So certainly there's a good reason to be expecting sort of interoceptive difficulties and actually expecting them to be present in pretty much every condition, but we must be sort of somewhat cautious that this sort of entire evidence base probably needs a recheck with some of the new measures that are coming out that are more robust to sort of being influenced by non-interoceptive factors, so just things like the tasks that make things easy, and also these differences in sort of stimulus strength. So to just give you an example of what I mean by that, one sort of older task is to get people to count the number of heartbeats that they perceive over a series of interval and then compare this to an objective count. But actually you can do really well on this if you just guess or if you count seconds. And so actually it's very, very difficult to know whether, you know, if someone's very, very poor at this task, well, you might be like, okay, they probably aren't perceiving anything. But actually at the higher end, where people are very, very good, it's actually very difficult to be like, is it because of perception or are they just very, very good at estimating or guessing what their heartbeat might be? And then the same way with lots of tasks, it's very difficult to know, like, is it just that this person has higher blood pressure or greater cardiac output than this other person who they've performed better than, or is it because they actually have some sort of greater perceptual ability? So interoception tasks are not really like an eye test where we line you all up in a row, same distance from sort of some letters that I want you to read, and I can be like, your perception is better than another individual's and I can correct this in this way. Actually, it's probably better thought of, or at least the way that we can measure it mostly now, as kind of running. So that in some individuals are faster or slower than other individuals, and that might be due to sort of one person being taller than another. So that actually it's very difficult to know, is this person a faster runner because of, you know, some training difference, or is it sort of some biological difference that is sort of the property of the individual that we can't change? If that makes sense.
Yes, it does. And it's really interesting to hear you say that, because when I've read about counting heartbeats as a way of evaluating how aware somebody was, I thought, well, I'd struggle to do that accurately myself. And yeah, I spend a lot of time scrutinizing what's going on in my body in response to other people in therapy, so I think I'm probably not too bad at being aware of what's going on inside, but I certainly wouldn't be able to do that task. But I was wondering, Jenny, about your own areas of research and what areas of clinical practice your research has had implications for.
Yeah, so I mean, I would say that all I've done is come up with ways that we measure interoception, and sort of really sort of suggested that we have this problem with how we're assessing this process. So that task that I just described, I've spent a lot of time criticizing. I would say that most of my contributions come from sort of thinking about the ways that individuals can differ with respect to interoception. And I'll pick up on the point that you just made in terms of the difference between sort of noticing internal bodily signals as well as sort of how accurate you can perceive them. And a lot of my work has looked at separating these two things. And of course, there's loads of ways that individuals might also differ with respect to interoception. But it used to be thought that these were kind of interchangeable in some way, like what you believed yourself to be wasn't necessarily related to your accuracy, but these were kind of measuring similar processes. But actually, we know that sort of attentional processes towards interoception are not the same as sort of your beliefs regarding how accurate you can perceive these signals. And some of these might map onto reality in some individuals, and in some they may not. So a lot of my work has been looking at sort of conceptualizing these individual differences in interoception and working out ways that we might measure them. Alongside this, a lot of my work has looked at trying to audit the field. So doing these kind of scoping reviews and meta-analyses where we synthesize all the work to kind of get a broad picture. And this is really useful where results are mixed in the field. So for example, I've done this in areas like sex differences in interoception, where surprisingly, at least on the older tasks, it's found that men generally outperform women on tasks of perception, but actually in these kind of more attentional aspects, women are reporting more attention to internal signals. And that has been my obsession, really, but since finding that, because I will be honest that I was like, this cannot be true. I don't believe this for one second. Something's gone wrong here. And so I've spent a lot of my time thinking about, okay, if this is true, why might it be? And if this isn't true, what might be contributing to this? And it's really interesting area because it sort of links in with some of the older research that was done in the 80s, not on cardiac perception, but things like blood pressure and blood glucose, where it's generally found that men outperform women in lab settings, but not in everyday life. And this suggests that, you know, people are using different cues for gauging their internal states. Yes, we can use perception, but actually you can also use other things like the external environment. So for working out when you're hungry, you might be like, okay, it's lunchtime, so I must be hungry. So for lots of these interoceptive signals, even if we're not perfect at perceiving them, we get a lot of information in our environment that we can use to kind of compensate for this, or just simply rely on another cue. I don't necessarily like the idea of thinking of that this as a poorer way of perceiving or processing or noticing these internal signals, but more of just a different way of regulating your body. But also in terms of this area, thinking about sort of, is it to do with increased amounts of physical change? Is it to do with some socialization process? Is it to do with stress? Is it to do with kind of bodily focus towards others, so caregiving, etc. So mostly theoretical work, looking at this, as well as sort of looking at links between interoception and conditions, which I would say mostly focused on anxiety. So I would say that in terms of clinical implications of my work, probably none. if I'm honest, because that isn't kind of the area that I have focused on. Certainly when I started my PhD in interception, I wanted to develop tasks of measuring this in infancy. I was really keen for these kind of big picture studies looking at, like, how does this develop and how does it contribute to all these things. And like happens in lots of fields, you end up actually going back to the very basics and spending quite a lot of time laying the groundwork to trust the work that you are doing. And that is really what I have been doing. And I would say that we do have some good and reliable measures now for looking at these things. And I'm sort of working at the moment on measuring interception across the menstrual cycle. It's never been done. So obviously we know that aspects of body perception change across the menstrual cycle, but does it actually change accuracy? And does it contribute to any differences in mood? We don't know. And so the idea is to run this sort of pretty hefty longitudinal study, 7 months, we'll see if people stay in it, to examine whether this varies, and also examine other things like effects of hormonal contraception, etc. So that's sort of where my focus is at the moment, but I would say probably realistically going to be 20 years before I start making any big strides towards clinical applications of this work. And I see this more as sort of making sure that things are done properly. But certainly you might say that it's because I actually, even though I might not admit it, quite enjoy the methods development and the sort of creative process that goes into working out interesting and fun ways to assess these individual differences.
But you can hear from the way you're talking that, you know, your research is really tied into wanting to contribute to understanding human beings and, you know, in a real world scenario. And I suppose, I did wonder after coming across your research online, but, you know, why haven't clinicians spent more time talking about this in the past? You know, it's not something that they covered during my clinical training. I don't know. I mean, clearly, David, it wasn't for you either. So, you know, why isn't it something that people are, clinicians are thinking and talking about more when it's so relevant to both physical and mental health?
I'm actually not sure about that. And if I was to take a guess, it would be that really until you have a way to sort of easily assess something and to make it useful for clinicians, perhaps it's not that helpful to know that this thing exists, but there is absolutely no advice on how to integrate this into your clinical practice. So that would be my guess, that maybe it's just too soon for these things to be coming in. But certainly thinking about sort of the processing of internal bodily signals does play a role in things like mindfulness-based therapies to some extent, and also this idea of the sort of distracting away from the internal to focus on the external is like a useful tool, I think in CBT, I might be wrong, but yeah, this idea of kind of distracting away from bodily sensations if they're bothering you. Obviously, when we say internal in CBT, usually it's not just sort of body signals, but it certainly has been applied in that way. So often I wonder if actually a big problem in just all of science is people doing similar things and using different words for the same thing. So even if you haven't come across the term interception, you've probably come across these ideas of sort of somatic symptoms and bodily perception and physiological reactivity and such. So all of these things sort of tie in to the same sort of umbrella, I would say, of, you know, signals around your body or the internal world, but are perhaps just the more experimental psychology terms like interception haven't made their way into sort of the clinical sphere yet. But I wouldn't say that it means that these aren't being talked about at all. I just think often people are using different words to talk about very similar things.
I was thinking while you're talking that in psychotherapy, and I'm sure you do too, we think about introspection and the kind of monitoring of the body that you were mentioning earlier on, Naomi. And certainly as a psychotherapist, you're really trained to always be aware of what's happening throughout your body, but not really conceptualizing it in quite the way that you're describing and expanding, Jenny.
I think that actually I spoke at a conference recently that was trying to kind of integrate everything. So it was sort of medics, clinicians, as well as researchers and such, kind of trying to get everyone in the same room to sort of get the differing perspectives on this sort of mind-body sphere. And it is really useful to have that kind of cross-fertilization across different fields and bring in these different perspectives. It's something that I think isn't done often enough. And it's useful for researchers because researchers want their research to be useful. But it's also, I think, very useful for making sure that we're not kind of reinventing the wheel, as it were. So often I think it's challenges can come about where we realise that actually we're spending all this time solving this problem that has been solved in another field already. And I don't think, I'm not talking about interception specifically, I'm just talking about science in general.
I absolutely love that you said that, Jenny. And I think certainly sort of when I think for some of our listeners, they probably think of, for David and I, both our backgrounds are in the criminal justice system. And I think they probably expect at times, maybe I'm wrong, but I think people might expect us to stick to a very narrow niche focused on forensic work. But actually, when I was working in a prison, I always felt that it was really important. Prisons felt like a silo, and it always felt really important to look outside and look for information that had some kind of Venn diagram meeting in the middle, where there was the possibility for more learning. And I think that's what we've tried to do on the podcast, you know, have on guests that offer something that lends itself to the human experience that would can then have some direct relevance for forensic work. So you can hear that very much in what you're talking about. And but I think there's something about the labelling of the whole concept of interception, actually, because I felt that I was quite good at paying attention to somatic processes, but it was during this training where interception was spoken about very explicitly, where there was an encouragement to notice and give attention to that, and how, you know, for me, the sensory motor training was really kind of like quite life changing as a therapist, and not just as a therapist actually, because I've used it in my personal life as well. But there's certainly something very profound about giving attention to what's going on internally that seemed much deeper by the labelling of this process I'd found in other therapy models when training. So for me, I really feel there should be more discussion of this for clinicians in training, but I hear what you're saying about what some of those barriers might be.
Well, this next question is a bit of a biggie, actually. Jane, do you think your work has anything to contribute to the discussion about whether thoughts, feelings and behaviour comes first? Which of those might come first?
Oh, this is a tough one. This is a tough one. I think that the way that we measure interception at the moment is you invite people into the lab, you get them to do a task, say a cardiac perception. Maybe if you're using my app, you do it outside of the lab, and then you get them to do some other task, like an emotional processing task. You might see whether they are able to perceive facial emotions in some other person, and you might get them to fill out a load of questionnaires, and then you look at the relationships between the two. I would say actually what's more interesting to me and where I'm trying to go with things is, do we use these signals online? Do people vary in how they're using these signals, integrating them? When we have both internal and external information available, which are we relying on more? You know, sometimes it's going to be useful to pay attention and use your internal states, and sometimes it's not going to be useful whatsoever. So you can think about things like if you have chronic pain, well, we don't want you focusing on your internal signals all the time, because actually that might not be good for you whatsoever. If paying attention to your body makes you feel anxious, then that's not going to be useful for you either. If you can't perceive these internal signals whatsoever, but you're absolutely able to, you know, process emotions and such by using external information, why do we need to train it? So I would say that actually the way that we measure interoception probably can't tell us anything about the time course of this kind of thoughts, feeling and behaviour, purely because of the way that we have generally assess this. And people are trying to do things using wearables, using sort of innovative tasks and such, but I would say we're way far away from being able to actually sort of say, okay, what is coming first and what is the contribution of interoception to these things. You know, is it that you have a thought and that results in a change in your bodily state and vice versa, and then, you know, do you act without awareness, do you not? I mean, most of this is going to be that I would guess that it varies depending on the context and situation and what we're talking about, and I'm sure that it varies just as much within individuals as it does between individuals. But in terms of the contribution of interoception to this, or whether it can shed any light, I would say that we're certainly not there yet, or at least I haven't come across any work reading myself. I'll probably get told by a colleague after they listen to this that there's some study that I haven't read, as is typical. But to my knowledge, I don't believe that there is any work that would sort of be lending or pointing towards a clear sort of feed forward loop with regards to those three things. But I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on what you think, how it might contribute.
Well, of course, it's these questions at the root of, you know, many controversies in psychology and psychotherapy. So I was hoping that you'd, you know, bring some of these disagreements and uncertainties, you know, to rest, but not quite yet.
Oh, I'm afraid I've got nothing for you at the moment, but I'll add it to my to-do list. I feel like this is this isn't one that I thought about, actually, with respect to interoception. And it's a good question, because you can see how at least measuring physiology may be useful for sort of teasing these things apart, particularly with cleverly designed experiments, when it's useful and when it's not useful to use that information. But we don't really even have tasks that can use can measure this process of sort of your, I think I've called it, propensity to use internal versus external signals. We don't even really have a way of measuring this yet.
What do you think, Naomi? You're multi-trained and highly experienced.
I guess I was curious from the, you know, from the perspective of, if you know, if you think about one particular model, CBT, where there is this assumption that if you change the thoughts that you're going to change the feelings, and you know, my experience in reality is that it's not always that clear cut for people, and that seems to be what you're saying, you know, and that might say something about what kind of, you know, the importance of formulating accurately in terms of deciding whether somebody should get CBT rather than deciding that everybody should have CBT as a treatment for problems.
Yeah, I would agree with that, that kind of individualized approach being more beneficial. In terms of, like, it's a difficult one, because CBT is, if we go back to this idea of emotions, are you notice a change in your body state and then you interpret it. You know, it's your interpretation of the context that determines how you label your emotion. So in some ways you could say that changing your thinking will contribute to changes in emotions. But individuals may vary with how much they weight the internal versus the context. So if you don't weight the context at all, it might be quite hard to change that. But equally, it doesn't mean that you won't notice a change in your bodily state. That's still going to occur. It just may be that you are going to sort of interpret that away in some ways, and that could be useful for some people, and I'm sure it is for some people, particularly if you have an inclination towards sort of fearing the worst in different situations. But actually, sometimes this is useful information. Sometimes you do need this, and so simply sort of constantly interpreting things in a positive light isn't going to be ideal either. So if I break my leg, you don't want me being like, it's absolutely fine, I'll be fine, I can go do this marathon. You know, that wouldn't be ideal. You know, the change in the bodily signal is, if we come back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, is a warning that something's awry. And yes, we may have an inclination to you know, go too far with this. Health anxiety is a good example of this in the kind of physical realm. But actually, you know, if we just simply ignore all these signals, that's not ideal either. Again, coming back to this idea that we don't know what the perfect balance of these things are, and that yes, it may be that work on interception can contribute towards sort of understanding, you know, when things will be useful for an individual and when they won't be. And I can see that there are benefits of CBT for some individuals, and some people find it helpful. But I wouldn't say that my thinking on CBT is it's sort of some panacea for all. Like, it's,
yeah. No, I think the kind of like the most obvious example, for instance, might be to, or that comes to my mind anyway, is to think about, you know, people who've been victims of crime. So someone who was physically abused or sexually abused in childhood, blaming themselves, and then over the course of therapy managing to change their cognitions around the fact that it was not their fault. But actually then you might get them into a circumstance where some context where something's triggered that reminds them, so whether it be a smell or a taste or a look from somebody, and then all of a sudden the self-blaming cognitions come back, because what we know intellectually is not necessarily as, we don't necessarily have that as felt knowledge, and that there needs to be some integration between what we feel and what we know in a cognitive way.
Yeah, very interesting. So actually you could theorize that you would end up with this, you almost create this sort of dissociation between your thinking and the sort of sensory evidence that you have, and that actually disconnect would be quite distressing, I would imagine, as well, and then sort of set an individual back in this way. I would say that at least for what we know about interception at the moment, we're probably not at the point that we're sort of able to integrate these things all together. And when I say CBT-based approaches to the processing of internal bodily signals, when we talk about things like interceptive training, it is generally thinking about, you know, the education, a bit like the asthma studies I was telling you about earlier. So generally it's not a huge amount. So it will be this kind of, right, on the one hand, you've got your heart rate is going to change over the course of the day. This is what's normal. This is what might be atypical and you might need to worry about. And here are ways that you can deal with things. So you can notice your bodily signals. You can think about the way that you're interpreting them. And if they're bothering you, and you, after when you notice them, you sort of see that there's nothing to be worried about, it may be useful to distract your attention away. And so that's when we're sort of thinking about the CBT aspects being useful, and that does have some element of, like, you know, changing one's thinking, but it also has that other element of, like, recognizing what is typical, you know, noticing normal bodily changes. And normal could be that, you know, it's completely normal that if you, I don't know, you come back to your house and you open the door and you get a scare. I get this all the time when I've hung my coat up and I think someone's in the house. I do this all the time. And yet I still don't move the coat stand. And you get a fright. And that's normal. If I didn't have that bodily response, there would be something wrong. This is warning me. And I need these bodily signals, and I can notice them, and then I can sort of you know, recognize, okay, this is a normal bodily response, I'm not about to have a heart attack, everything's fine, you know, my heart rate is going to speed up because I've just had a little shock, in the same way that if we're watching a horror film, we expect to have a jump and our heart rate to go up. And then if it's bothering you still after you've realised that there's nothing to be concerned about, then it might be useful to distract your attention away from those internal sensations, such that by drawing your attention away from them, you are less bothered by them. And this is kind of where interoceptive training has been used in the past to sort of help things like anxiety. But certainly this idea of just, you know, change all your thinking around your bodily signals, that's probably not going to be useful in every context at all, I would say.
So thanks very much indeed. So you've mentioned earlier on that these phenomena have been studied since 1906, so that's 118 years. And yet I think it still probably remains one of the least kind of prominent areas of research and study. So how did you become interested in it?
So it's an interesting one in terms of, like, is it the least prominent? It's certainly popular at the moment. My goodness, since I started doing it, I'd never heard of the term, but now you see it popping up on sort of, you know, reading lists at undergraduate and master's levels and things like that. So it's certainly getting more focus, and there's certainly loads of researchers interested in interception at the moment. But certainly if we look across all those years, not much interest until the last sort of 15-20 years. So I have a weird career trajectory to getting into academia. I went to a theatre school, I then went to a dance college, I then trained as a personal trainer. I decided to go back to university after sort of leaving dance college and training as a personal trainer because I was interested in psychology. I was very much sure that I was going to do a conversion course to law at the end of it. That's kind of where I saw myself working. And then I got interested in research. I worked as a research assistant, actually focused still on perception, but fixed perception rather than interception. And I did that over the course of my 3 years of undergraduate studies, and applied for a PhD actually focused on face perception. And when I arrived at my supervisor's lab, he'd said, oh, you know, there's this cool paper that's come out, we did a commentary on it, maybe you'd be interested in this, no pressure, we can always go back to the other idea if you want to, but have a little look. And I did, and I was like, oh, this is way more up my street than I was proposing. I have loads of ideas, it's all exciting and it's new. And then I just fell into it and actually sort of spent the first, I would say, year or so trying to do very exciting project answering sort of questions that I was very, very keen to answer. And then the data looked weird. This wasn't coming out exactly how we would have expected. And really that sort of prompted this increased focus on measurement. And that's really how I ended up in interception at all. And I've stayed in this area because I find it interesting, and I don't think that I will leave this area until I understand what's going on with sex differences in interception, because that was the real kind of nerdy moment, I would say, where I remember finding this in a study that I'd run with a kind of sample of about 140 men and women between sort of 18 to 90. And I was like, this cannot be true. There's no way this is true. And as I kept looking into this more detail, I found, okay, it's not just me finding this, other people have found this, and they found it in other areas, blood pressure, blood glucose, nicotine, etc. And so once I got hooked on that, that's really kept me in the field, alongside the sort of creativity of developing new methods and working with collaborators that I really enjoy collaborating with. But yeah, sometimes you get you get stuck on something, and that's really what motivates you day to day, because you have a key question that you're determined to have an answer to for yourself more than anything else.
And you're in the midst of writing a book on interception at the moment, I believe, Jenny. Can you tell us a little bit about it and when it's likely to come out?
Yeah, so I should say that there's quite a few books on interception that are knocking around. So the idea of this one is a textbook. So at the moment, there isn't really a sort of up-to-date textbook that goes through all the nuance. I mean, this is everything from the history of interception, you know, interception in different conditions, how it contributes to various different processes, how it differs across individuals, how it differs across groups, interceptive intervention, that sort of thing. And so the idea is that this is useful as interception gains more prominence for different courses. So whether that be clinically focused courses, as well as courses at like undergraduate and master's level. So I can't take credit for writing. I've only contributed to one of the chapters in the book, but I've certainly been reading and editing all of these. And it's quite exciting because most textbooks aren't actually reviewed, so they don't go through peer review. But me and the co-editor decided that all of these chapters would be reviewed because there isn't actually much consensus in the field regarding a lot of things with interception. So I would say that as well as being a kind of nice introduction to interception, which is what it will be called when it is finally published at the end of the year, hopefully it will also serve as a sort of record of the consensus at the time. And I will hope that in the next sort of 5, 10, 15 years, I'll be editing and updating this textbook as the sort of newer knowledge comes in. And I think of this as a nice way to sort of see how much progress has been made, because often you can think that there's not much progress in the field until you take that sort of bird's eye view. And I would say that, yeah, doing this textbook has definitely made me more excited about my field than I perhaps had been, because sometimes if you are down in the weeds, you forget about all the potentially exciting and theoretical ideas that do exist, and the cool work that people are doing to kind of drive the field forward. So yeah, that should be out towards the end of this year, hopefully.
And that sounds like a book that a lot of practitioners should have on their bookshelf as well. But we're just coming to the end of time, Jenny, and just as a final question, I just wondered, for anyone who's listening to you talk, are there any things that people could be taking from your research that could help them improve their own well-being by thinking about interception?
Yeah, I think that the main thing I always get asked, like, how do I improve my interception? And that seems to be one that comes up over and over again. And my answer to that is that we don't even know what the optimal level is. So I wouldn't obsess too much about your interception at all. Obviously, if processing internal bodily signals, paying attention to them is, you know, you feel that you're paying too much attention to them, and when you do pay attention, they bother you, then there are strategies that we know that can be helpful, like we talked about earlier, distracting away, but also just recognize that most of the time we shouldn't be paying attention to our bodily signals. They feed in, you know, they're being processed outside of our conscious awareness, and they're contributing to things. And most of the time we don't need to pay attention to them unless they're warning us that something has gone awry. So if you're spending all of your time processing and focusing on your bodily signals, that's not actually likely to be very useful to you. And it's sort of worth noting that there are different ways that we can process our internal bodily signals using internal information, but also using external. And so there's not necessarily a right and wrong way of going about this. So if anything, it would be that recognize that we as a field don't really know enough to give you a recommendation in terms of what you should be doing to improve your interception, or, you know, what you should be doing for sort of processing of these signals, but actually recognizing that it's a sort of old system for making sure that you maintain balance, and it warns you if something is awry. And yes, sometimes that's useful for sort of our physical health, but actually sometimes our bodies go a bit too far and will be warning us that there is a coat that is in the hallway, when actually that's not useful information. And so if we're really stressing out about that afterwards, and it's hard for our bodies to calm down, it's okay not to pay attention to your bodily signals in those moments. When you know everything's okay, you know, it might be time to think about focusing on the external and distracting away, because my research generally suggests that the more attention we pay to our internal signals, generally the more negative our mood. So it is useful to pay attention to your bodily signals, but not too much. only when it's helpful.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Jenny. Enjoyed that conversation.
That was brilliant. Thanks very much indeed, Jenny.
My pleasure.